I mean, you know, I'm sitting here trying to spin around on my chair, and I'm slipping and sliding with this paper. I got to get some grip. I didn't mean to do that. You can take care of that for me, Peter. Listen close. Maybe what Satan knew was much more important. That in the plan of God all along, Moses and Elijah were going to be those last two witnesses. Enoch will get plenty of credit. He built the monument that will stand in the center of Egypt and at the border thereof. He laid down the plan of the world and prophecy in the pyramid that will enable God to say, I told you so, as stated in Isaiah 19. Did God plan for Moses and Elijah to be those last two witnesses? If he did, then you can understand the training he put them through. Because God's whole... Do you realize after the centuries of dealing and fighting with Satan to bring forth the veracity of his word and to bring forth a people that he can show off before the denizens of eternity, everything stands on two witnesses? What if one of them breaks under the pressure? What if Satan can get to two of them, or one of them? Now you understand why Moses and Elijah received some of the toughest training. And they had practice in working the miracles that will be worked by those two witnesses. Now God got the jump on the devil. He zipped old Elijah up in his chariot and there wasn't any fight over his body. But when Moses died, Jude says, Satan and Michael fought over the body of Moses. And Michael had to win it. And Michael dare not curse Satan. He was that powerful. And that's why there is absolutely no question but what the Book of Revelation passage where Michael is released to cast Satan out. The book of Job and the wrestling over the body of Moses proves that's yet to be a future event. Because he has not yet been cast out. And Michael wasn't free to curse him. Just to possess the body of Moses. Because Satan knew. If he had got Moses' body, God's plan for those last two witnesses would have been interfered with, if they're the two. And they're the most likely candidates. But the point to what I'm doing now is you can't read the Bible without encountering these things. What do you do with them? I mean, what did the demoniac of the Gadarenes have? Gas pains? You see, that's rather gross. Not half as gross as what possessed him. Now, I'm trying to show that there's empirical evidence, once again, to verify the Bible's position. I've seen people from little limited perspectives say, because the Bible reports miracle or reports these supernatural dimensions, it ought to be written off out of hand. Hey, I started to read in an earlier hour a continuation of the study of the shaman. Joan Halifax, shaman. Joan Halifax, PhD, medical anthropologist and director of the Ojai Foundation. Research at Columbia and Miami University. A Harvard faculty member. This is not a subject just for nuts. For the shaman, all that exists in the revealed world has living force within it. This life energy force, like the Polynesian Mana or the Sioux Indian Wakanda, is conceived of as a divine force which permeates all. You study matter and antimatter, you're going to find there's energy. And to the shaman, energy, life, and power are synonymous. Many of the great religions of the Far East have that same concept. The shaman personalizes all phenomena. I suppose in that sense, a form of pantheism. But it's personalized life in all phenomena. Again, I say, you study the phenomena of matter and antimatter, and virtual reality, as the scientists call it. The shaman may have hold of something. The shaman personalizes all phenomena in the universe, endowing them with human qualities. The tree trembles beneath the axe. The drum wails under the baton. All things have emotions which are subject to influence. Have you ever heard of people that talk to flowers? They'll swear you treat a flower right, it'll grow better. And you stop the average Westerner, you see the smirk instantly when you say that. We just have developed in recent years the ability to photograph the aura. See, naturalism so oversimplified life, it was in danger of making it diminutive and destroying its outreach. Now, I'm interested primarily in showing that modern science and psychical research will confirm the Bible and once again prove it right. You don't have to abandon your faith for intellectual reasons. The Bible was more right all along than the scientist who taught me in university. That's a major point. But now, I've been reading in The Demonologist by Jill Brittle, Ed and Lorraine Warren, hoping to make the point that the Catholics at least know who the enemy is. I've been reading The Devil in Connecticut, The Strange Case of Demon Possession of David Glatzel. Turn the lights down so some more can sneak out. I'm going to get scary now. I need to tell you the viewpoint that the Warrens have, and many who deal with this phenomenon. They believe that there are spirits out there. That's very biblical, good and bad. And we're caught between. But most of Christianity camps out on one of two extremes. Soul sleeping. When you die, it's just vast black nothingness, white nothingness, or nothingness until the day of the resurrection. And the others, it's an instant express trip to the presence of Christ. And I'm telling you, if you have faith, and if you understand what Paul says, death is the beginning. Paul says, the time of my departure is at hand, and every time I preach a funeral as a pastor, there will never be an exception. I will use that text somewhere in the message where Paul says, the time of my departure is at hand. The word in the Greek is very unique, very specific, exclusively used to characterize a ship laden for the journey, just leaving the harbor, just getting started. It is the semantical trick of morticians and cemeteries to talk about death as rest. Paul talked of death as beginning the trip. Everything was preparation. The time of my departure is the same as you've prepared for a trip. And now you walk across the boardwalk and you get on the ship just starting your trip. And if you've got faith and understanding, that's what death ought to be. But those who engage in this kind of research have piled up a mountain, and there's an entire society in Britain that has monitored and researched tens of thousands of cases. And there are too many people entirely ignorant of the research that just write it off. It's like parapsychology. For years, extrasensory perception was considered to be trickery, until major universities in America began to research it and the threshold was crossed. It is no longer an issue whether it happens. The question is how, what, and by what means. Research has mounted over the last few years. I think as God is preparing the day of the end, until more and more nobody will have excuse for afterlife evidenced experience. And those who research it postulate an in-between happening on occasions. A sudden death, a surprise death, an accident, an unprepared for death. A happening where the person is not is unlike Paul, ready for his departure and eagerly anticipates it, but even though he could say as Paul did, better for me, absent from the body, is to be present with the Lord. But he has a job to do. But when the time of the departure has come, it's just getting started for him. These researchers postulate the happening of some departed souls or spirits who haven't quite got it all together. Caught by surprise, a sudden accidental death or something. This is their research, their conclusions. The spirit's still a little bit confused, or the soul, they interchange the words. And it can't quite turn loose yet and move on. Now, some serious questions are raised by this. If you introduce the doctrines of hell. Because if you are dying and going the wrong way, who in hell would want to turn loose? A big gap in the research is that most of these people are talking of those who die going the right place, heading for the light. They don't really say it that way. It's just a light, and they go to it, and somewhere beyond they find their destiny. But in between, now this is a brand new addition to what I've been doing. And if I hadn't shown you for several days, I'm not any nut. I'm just laying it all out on the table till we can begin to gestalt the simple conclusion. There's an awful lot of stuff out there that needs to be considered. Now we're talking about ghosts. Somebody asked me, did you plan this the Halloween time? No, I didn't. It just all of a sudden happened. I've had these books around, most of them, for years. Some of them know that all of you are helping me and sending me things. But some deaths, they postulate, the soul or spirit, the essential self or whatever name they give it, doesn't want to leave for whatever reason and hangs around, or doesn't know it's supposed to leave. Hangs around. In short, it sort of marches into eternity backwards, still looking back. And unlike Lot's wife, there's no salt pillars in between. So they hang around till they get a message across. Remember the ghost at West Point that Ed and Lorraine dealt with? When he could finally get across, they could get across to him, go now to the light. Everybody knows you weren't guilty. Now, in the ghost of Flight 401, you're dealing with that kind of phenomenon. A sudden accidental death, and Don Repo not yet ready to go. Still hanging around. Now, up till now, with the little bypass on the ghost at West Point. We've concentrated on angelic versus demonic forces, correct? And I'm well aware. I come out of a historic church stream. So I'm well aware of the repercussions and the disraveling when we start talking about that other phenomenon, ghosts, departed spirits, still around. Well, I never heard of such a thing. Well, these people, and a lot of people, have encounters with them that they perceive to be the presence capable of manifesting to the point of recognition of one who's dead, and yet his self or herself can materialize in part or whole and be perceived and communicate with the living. That's what they call ghosts versus inhuman spirits. Well, I never heard of such a thing. You ever hear of Samuel and the witch at Endor and Saul? In the Old Testament, Saul went to the witch of Endor. And she brought up a manifestation that Saul perceived as Samuel, and the manifested one, or the manifestation per se, went along with the idea. Now, what really happened? What really happened? Did Samuel manifest? Did he come forth? Or was there some spirit being out there who played the role? And if so, why? Now, either there's only here and now and no hereafter, and no out there and no other. Or there is here and now and there another. Now, Paul says, we look not on the things which are seen, but on the things which are unseen. Things which are seen are temporal. Things which are unseen are eternal. Well, you can poeticize it. But I think the context drives you to the conclusion Paul meant it to be literal. Right? Now, what happened to my book? Oh, there it is. Thought it dematerialized for a minute. Now, listen to me. Or if it is accepted, there is a there and other as well as a here and now. Then you can assume the there and other is all good or all bad, or degrees of both. The historic Hebraic Christian position is there is a there and another, and they're at war. And the good's going to win ultimately, but there's a struggle going on, and we are the prize. In Christianity, is not a mode of self-pottery making whereby we are forever shaping ourselves in an imitation of God. It is a warfare in which we become the vessel or instrument by which the powers of God prevail against the powers of evil, and we wrestle not against flesh and blood. That's basic Christianity. Yeah. Is there evidence of such conflict? Now we're introducing another dimension, a sphere in between, departed souls, not yet realized in fullness, but very much alive, but in a different state of being. These researchers postulate some of those in an in-between, sometimes confused, sometimes malignant in attitude, in between area, where they still have contact with the here and now, haven't accepted that they now belong to the there and other, and they ought to get on with the trip. They're still swimming around in the harbor. That's what these people postulate. But an alternative is that in the there and other, the evil demonic forces may have the capacity to imitate. Now, was that materialization Samuel? Or was an evil force by this witch of Endor impersonating Samuel? Your a priori theological position will determine the conclusion. There is no way the text can prove either one. But in either case, you're dealing with the there and other. If you assume it really was Samuel, then he was somewhere in between available to that witch. And you better believe, I have great respect for Samuel, but I sure don't want to be available to a witch when I'm gone. I mean, I'm going to build a rocket on my tail and shoot on out of here. If I can. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, this book I do not recommend. I won't buy it and put it in my bookstore. It could have been a great book. I'm sorry. It is written as a sequel. The girl was a Northwest Orient Airlines stewardess. She became a research assistant to a journalist. They became partners in the study and lovers. They began to intensely research the evidence for the ghost of Flight 401. She discovered in a seance that she had embryonic psychic powers and began to develop those powers. John, throughout most of the research, was a hard-nosed, look-for-evidence journalist. The book could have been a great one, but she fills it full of so much personal, from some of her gripes about the routinizing of the stewardess pattern on Northwest Orient Airlines to all the little side trips to restaurants. I suppose to some it makes a nice story, but for a researcher on this subject, you have to wade through too much non-essential to get to the essential. So take it from me, if you want to read it, you can. It's very honest on the cover. It says a ghost story, a love story, a true story. And there's too much of the love story and not enough for the rest of it for my purposes. If you want the love story, have at it. I don't like waste time when I'm researching. But it's got some amazing stuff in it. Some of it oftentimes Repo appeared to deliver a warning that something harmful was going to happen to the L-1011. And crew members would see him. And she, too, could not, the journalist couldn't get anything out of these people. Where'd my handkerchief go? There it is. But being a person of the trade, even though a crew member of another airline, she was able to talk at length. And in the book, which may weaken the credulity in the minds of some, she was forced to use, by agreement, artificial names for the Eastern Airlines crew members that she interviewed because they're not allowed to talk about it for fear they would be forced to go to the company's shrink and be fired. But in this research, she became quite an expert on psychical research. And she summarizes some of the interesting little items in the research. Let me read you one. And by the way, she finally brings the hard-nosed journalist around and a large section of the book from about that much to the end of it. They finally begin to communicate with Don Repo on a Ouija board. And they carry on lengthy conversations, finding out things through the Ouija board no way they could have known. And even old John becomes converted at that point, and he writes the book, The Ghost of Flight 401. She then does the sequel with John doing an epilogue, My Search for the Ghost of Flight 401. Now I want to read you something. You ready? Get ready. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. My Search for the Ghost of Flight 401. Is this a Bantam book or what? Nonfiction. Elizabeth Fuller. Who's the publisher? Berkeley Medallion Books. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the noted neuropsychiatrist, had spent 25 years of her practice studying dying patients. According to a story published in Newsweek and several newspapers, several years after she decided to drop that sort of study, a woman entered her office. What's going on back there? Shut that door. According to a story published in Newsweek and several newspapers, several years after she decided to drop that sort of study, a woman entered her office. Dr. Kubler-Ross immediately recognized the woman as a patient who had died 6 months earlier. The woman sat down across from Dr. Kubler-Ross's desk and told her that she was disappointed in the doctor's decision to give up studying dying patients. Dr. Kubler-Ross's thoughts flashed back to all the times she had counseled patients who had reported seeing such apparitions. She conducted a quick reality test, asking the woman to write down her name and address. The patient did so, and then walked right out of the door. Startled, Dr. Kubler-Ross verified the slip of paper against other documents signed by the former patient. The signatures were identical. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is now incidentally lecturing all over the world on her convictions of the reality of life after death. This girl, and I will say this, you know, she's not the world's best writer, and she mixes a lot of extraneous stuff, but she really got into studying, and her research is amazing. But she says, and it's interesting to watch her own growth from total skeptic, more turned on by John, the researcher, whom she met on a trip, than the subject itself. But as she gets into the subject, it's amazing to watch her transformation as she's exposed to facts. Now, the Bible and Christianity ought to remove the fear of death. That's probably the greatest fear that Satan holds over mankind. And Jesus took that key from him, if Christianity's correct. And you can quickly sort out how much faith people have when death's on the horizon. If I had known about Dr. Kubler-Ross's studies before this course that she was in, I probably would have been more open to what Patricia was talking about, and she was in a particular class at the time. I was also to discover that another psychiatrist had a paranormal experience. Hey, I keep asking my people to share with me their experiences. The ones that trust me and trust my ability to hold confidence. But I'm not reading, I hope you notice, that I'm not reading from the nutty fringe as the intellectual world would consider it. Another psychiatrist had a paranormal experience. In fact, Dr. George Ritchie's own account of life after death had inspired Dr. Raymond A. Moody to write his bestseller, Life After Life. Dr. Moody even dedicated the book to him. In 1943, when Dr. Ritchie was in the service, now, I'm really sorry that the folks in Dallas did not hear the full trip of the shaman last night and the archaeologist, and you'll hear it on a rerun. But his experience into realms of life and the shaman's trips into the underworld. Because you need to see the connections and the common denominators. In 1943, when Dr. Ritchie was in the service, he was selected to go to the University of Virginia Medical School. How about my dad? Some of you have heard him tell his experience. Out of the body, in the coma with rheumatic fever in 1936. But let me tell this. In 1943, when Dr. Ritchie was in the service, he was selected to go to the University of Virginia Medical School. He said that at that time in his life, he felt as if he had the world by the tail. By the time he reached the age of 25, he was sure he would have a home on the beach and a Cadillac in his garage. Now, I want to tell you, when you study shamans, by either discipline or, in many cases, a severe sickness, they withdraw, so to speak, from the normal world and are put in a position where they entertain, concentrate on, and encounter this other dimension of life. I mean, when you're so wrapped up in the things of this world, it doesn't really interest you, the subject. Either by voluntary choice and discipline and suffering, or through sickness involuntarily, many times, that becomes the catalyst that drives them over the hill, so to speak, to encounter this vast dimension of life most of us never encounter. Which, by the way, is one of the reasons why the gift of healing in the most fundamental circles usually operates with most effectiveness through someone that has faced death and come back from that chaotic threshold through healing themselves. Let's go on. By the time he reached the age of 25, he was sure he would have a home on the beach and a Cadillac in his garage. However, 5 days before he was to enter medical school, he landed in the hospital with an upper respiratory infection. By 3 a.m., he felt terrible. He asked the ward boy what his temperature was and discovered it was 106. The ward boy ran for the doctor. A chest x-ray was immediately ordered for Ritchie. Ritchie said the last thing he could remember was the x-ray. Later, he found out that he had been pronounced dead. There was no pulse, no blood pressure. He had died from double lobar pneumonia. The ward boy was ordered to prepare him for the morgue. 10 minutes after he had been declared dead, another doctor came in and confirmed it. Somehow, the ward boy insisted that they try giving him a shot of adrenaline. This was considered highly dangerous because it could create a living vegetable, but the heart started almost immediately. Recalling his terrifying experience, Ritchie told later what happened during the time he, quote, died. I sat up on the side of my bed. You've heard my dad tell the story. He saw himself laying in the bed and felt himself as though carried in the arms of someone. When he approached heaven, he saw his mother waving him home. Then the scene changed, and other scenes changed. When he said, by the way, "I'm ready to go, Lord, but I hate to leave my wife and boy." And then the series of scenes changed. There are others that can tell stories like that. "I sat up." Now, the doctors are pronouncing him dead. Here's Richie's side of it. "I sat up on the side of my bed, upset that I would miss my train back to Richmond. What I wasn't prepared for was looking back and seeing myself lying there." Do you realize how wonderful it would be if people could be exposed to enough evidence to really know? I mean, live it to the fullest. Make faith work to the maximum. But if you could really know with the certainty those New Testament Christians had, until they had to be sometimes kept from seeking a martyr's grave, that this life is but preparation for another, and death is the doorway, the departure point, as Paul put it. Well, let's just read on. The psychiatrist. "I wasn't prepared for looking back and seeing myself lying there. I felt myself rise from the foot of the bed and walk across the corridor. I saw a ward boy rolling a stretcher down it," the corridor that is, "and I walked right through the stretcher and out the hospital door. I seemed to travel at the speed of sound. I was determined to get to Richmond. I found myself lying on the street next to an illuminated cafe. Soldiers passed me. I tried to speak, but they walked right through me." He went on to report that he had left his body back on the bed. Suddenly he realized that if a ward boy or the man on the street hadn't seen him and passed right through him, something was wrong. He simply had to go back and pick up his body. But he couldn't remember what room he was in. The hospital had over 3,000 beds. Dr. Ritchie continues his description. "It was a real identity crisis, physical identity crisis. After what seemed like hours, I found my body. But the sheet was pulled over my head." It seemed like hours to him. "But the sheet was pulled over my head. I could tell because my hand was sticking out and my fraternity ring with a chipped stone was still on my hand. I noticed that my hand was very blue. I was horrified. I then sat on the bed and tried to pull the sheet off my body. But I failed. The situation hit Dr. Ritchie like a ton of bricks. He knew that it must be death." Well, is this one going further and too far? I don't know if I should continue on this subject. Now, in the Ghost of Flight 401, a Christian couple who believe, and another of psychical research bent, heard so much about Don Repo continuing to appear on 1011s, particularly one plane, that they dedicated themselves to a soul-freeing session to let him know, "Hey, man, go toward the light and go on to the next life." And after they performed that soul-freeing effort, there weren't any more reports of it. But let me go on with Dr. You want to go on, Dr. Ritchie? "I'm not sure that they haven't turned me off. I mean, I don't like people to think I'm a nut. They do. When I'm gone, I'm going to hang around a while. Now, come on. Give me I want to know. I'm not too sure that I should continue on this subject. In fact, I don't think I should."